Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Pennsylvania has only executed three men since 1961. All three stopped contesting their death sentences and didn't continue to pursue appeals. In 2015, Governor Tom Wolf issued a moratorium on executions while a committee studied the death penalty in Pennsylvania. Last June, that committee issued its report and recommendations. It really hasn't settled the death penalty debate in Pennsylvania. On today's program, we're not going to have a debate. We're going to have your expected kind of conversation on Smart Talk about the death penalty and about the recommendations made by the committee. Joining us on today's program is Mark Bookman. He's co-director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. Mr. Bookman, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Also joining us is Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman, who is a member of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. District Attorney Stedman, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, sir. Good morning, Mr. Bookman.
How are you?
If you have a it's a little bit difficult on the phone, so there's a little bit of a hesitation there. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can get on WITF Facebook page and leave a question or comment. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mark Bookman, let's start with this report. This report was 7 years in the making. Governor Wolf said he wanted to await the results of this report before making any kind of decision on the moratorium on the death penalty. Overall, your thoughts on the report?
Well, I think it's pretty comprehensive. There are many issues regarding the death penalty that you've already touched on. The report itself has, I think, something like 18 different recommendations, and many of them, the report did not break new ground. I'll put it that way. Many states have studied the death penalty and have drawn very, very similar conclusions to this one, which makes sense. I mean, there's no reason to think that Pennsylvania is a particular outlier when it comes to the death penalty. You've already noted that we've only executed three people in 56 years, and all three of them were what we call volunteers. They didn't want to live anymore, so they gave up their appeals. So, obviously we have a death penalty system that's not working, and the question is, do we try to fix it, or do we abandon what I think is a failed public policy? So I think the report is pretty comprehensive, and I'm happy to talk about specific results that they came to.
And we're going to talk about some of the things that you feel are failed public policy in just a moment. Craig Stedman, your thoughts on the report?
Well, I think before I even talk about the report, I just want to emphasize a couple things. First of all, this is just an extremely serious issue, and absolutely respect those who oppose the death penalty on moral, religious, whatever grounds. And just, I'm coming here today as DA, representing the DAs, and our role is to provide for public safety. And there really is no more solemn discussion or decision that we have to make about whether we're going to pursue the death penalty. Even though no one's being executed and we don't effectively have a death penalty, we take it is that that's going to happen, and that's so serious with us. We just don't take it lightly. The decisions, when we do make it, they're selective, they're rare, extremely rare, and they should be. It's reserved for the worst of the worst, based on limited circumstances, based on the law, with victim input, and we absolutely take no pleasure in this. Everybody loses, everybody's lost, we lost a life, you've got the defendant, you've got the victim's family, and the defendant's family. So I want to also just say, I support the death penalty, but I'm also passionately against convicting the innocent person, and as DAs, we are ministers of justice, and our foundation of our country is liberty, it's justice, it's fairness, and part of that, justice requires accountability and sometimes the steepest price to be paid for certain cases. So as far as the, I just wanted to make sure we're clear on that. It's important, very important to have this discussion. It's great to look at different studies and see what people can offer. But as far as the report itself, obviously there's a lot of specifics in there. Extremely disappointed from our point of view, when we're looking at it, that it lacked any really serious research. It's essentially an advocacy piece. The makeup of the committee we knew where it was going to go. You could see where people were coming, and it's the same positions, and those are positions that need to be discussed and need to be out there. But the real disappointing thing for me was that there was this part of the resolution to create this commission was they had a study enacted by the Pennsylvania State University for the Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness, which studied 10 years, the last decade, from 2000 to 2010. John Kramer, PhD from Penn State, did it. And essentially, you know, made some very, very significant findings. It was research-based. It was statewide, not just Philadelphia, which some of the other studies this joint commission relied on. This was statewide. It was more recent. Methodology were more serious. And that report was essentially ignored in the joint commission study, and I think that's a real failure, and I could certainly talk about the specifics. Basically, what they said, what the Penn State found, was there's no pattern of disparity to the disadvantage based on race. And I think people were surprised by that, but that's fact-based. And I would have liked to seen, for this report to have more credibility, I would have liked to seen them look at the Kramer study, and not just, I think it appears in a footnote, but
it does. But I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but I do want to get into those specific recommendations that were made. But something you just said, and I want to be a little more forthcoming with this. One of the accusations, if I can use that word, that the DA's Association has made, and the others, some people who, a lot of people who do support the death penalty, is that the odds were stacked. That this committee going in, there were more people who were seen as anti-death penalty going in than those on the committee that were pro-death penalty. Now, my question is, what does it really matter? I mean, if the recommendations come out, they can be examined one by one, but does it matter? And I'm asking this question to you, Craig Stedman. Does it really matter what the makeup of the committee is?
Well, it does. It does matter because you're going to have predetermined solutions, and actually, Pam Grosch, my victim advocate for my office, was a member on it, and so I have a little bit of inside baseball as to what went on. You know, her committee hardly met. So, you know, to have a study like this with a magnitude of this, it is important that it's fair, that it's data-driven, it's not conclusion-driven. You know, we follow the facts and the law to get to a conclusion. You can't make your conclusion because you have a committee that has a inherent bias, and again, I respect opposition to the death penalty and everybody on that. But if you sort of had predetermined conclusions, having said that, I think it's important that we discuss all of these issues. I don't care whether it was 100% people were against the death penalty, and they're saying we should eliminate the death penalty. We need to take their voices seriously. We need to be balanced in what they're saying and look at the facts and look at the data. And that's why I think the Kramer report is so important, because he did look at the facts and the data. So, you know, I would say in the overall sense, yes, it really does matter. But in the sense of the importance of this issue and to have this discussion in our state and in our country, everyone's voice matters. Mm-hmm. Wherever you're coming from.
And so, Mark Pookman, let me turn to you. The points that Craig Stedman just made, I mean, if you know what the results are going to be before you go in, then there will be some question, some people who will question the credibility of the report.
Yeah, Scott, I respect what Mr. Stedman just said, but I think we should stick, you know, closely with the facts when we talk about this. So first of all, let's talk about the composition of the committee that studied this. There were two chiefs of police on there, four district attorneys, three judges, three victim advocates. It was hardly a stacked committee. The committee was actually very balanced. It's the facts that aren't balanced. You know, this is like criticizing a climate change report because half the report doesn't deny climate change. Here we have a public policy where no one's been involuntarily executed in 56 years. Hundreds of death sentences have been reversed. We've wasted a staggering amount of money for virtually nothing. So arguing that the report is unbalanced is saying, you know, let's ignore all of those problems so that we can have a decent argument, so that half the committee can say the death penalty is great and the other half says it's horrible and never the twain shall meet. Here, the facts tell us, the undisputed facts tell us that we have a major problem with how the death penalty operates. So I don't think it was the committee's lack of balance that was there. The facts just lead one to conclude that this policy isn't working.
So, Craig Stedman, I mean, the point that Mark brings up and that everyone will point to is that we have only executed three people since the early 1960s, and they basically did volunteer stop seeking their appeals. That would seem to say that, yes, we do have a problem with the implementation of the death penalty. So would you disagree with what Mark just said, that we have a flawed system?
No, I think we do have a flawed system, absolutely. And one of the problems is we have a death penalty, and we're not executing anybody. So we've got there's a tremendous amount of flaws in there, and we can start with the exhaustive appellate process that needs to be more efficient, needs to be more streamlined, it needs to be fair. I mean, we've got victim after victim after victim, the surviving ones, the ones that, you know, obviously the deceased has no voice. They don't have a right of appeal. And when you go out and you talk to the victims, I mean, this isn't a statistic. It's not a number. This is real world. This is real world stuff. And the worst thing that anybody could possibly imagine has happened to them in their life. And that's not even, you know, for the person who's lost their life and their hopes and dreams. And they get no second chance. They get no appeal. And these family members sit down with us, and they're looking for justice. We can't deliver what they want the most, which is to bring that person back. But I can't tell you how many conversations we've had decades after a jury has made a decision, and they're like, we're still early on in the appellate process. You know, there's surveys that we do, and we sit down with these people, and they feel, you know, it's a direct quote from a victim, the appeal process that criminals are given is not fair. The people who they murder are not given any appeals. They're dead. And so it's important. We want to get this right, and we want to have reforms that make sense, that are lead to justice. I think that there, you know, we can hopefully find some common ground, and that's not diminishing anybody's beliefs or opinions. But so I wholeheartedly agree that it's flawed, because I've done death penalty cases, and I can tell you, when you're looking in the jurors' eyes and you're talking to them about these sentences, they actually believe the person's going to be executed. And it tears at my heart to not say to them, by the way, you're not really talking about, we're talking about the biggest decision in the justice system you can make, but it really doesn't matter because you're just talking about how they're going to be housed. That's all we're talking about. And that really isn't right. And so I do agree. I mean, we come from different perspectives and want to see some different changes, but I think it's beyond all doubt that it's flawed, that you've got, I mean, we don't have it. People talk about the death penalty in Pennsylvania. We have it on the books, but we don't really have a death penalty. So I think that's the larger issue, is that we don't have death penalty in Pennsylvania, and we haven't for decades. So that's, I think, what we need to get back to. I mean, people support the death penalty. It's on the books. It's constitutional. It's been upheld many times, and there's ways to change the laws if you want to change the laws. But right now, that's the law, and we're not executing anybody for it. And you have these outlier cases. You can debate about the certain cases, but there's some we can just say, hey, you know, pick five, like Eric Freen or something, you know, who killed a police officer, almost killed another, word terrorized for weeks. There's no doubt about this man's guilt, and he has to have his appellate process. He's early on, but there's other ones that go back, ones that I did. Landon May, who broke into a couple's home in the middle of the night, hogtied them with tape, tortured them, sexually molested the female. We had, not only did he confess, we had a co-defendant say that he did it. We had DNA. His sperm was inside Lucy Smith's body. So, you know, there's no question of his guilt, and yet, you know, there's no chance of this person being executed. So, I wholeheartedly support the statement that the system's flawed.
All right, you brought up appeals. There are a lot of other issues there that we have to discuss. We'll get to them in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing a report that was put up by a committee last June about the death penalty, death sentences here in Pennsylvania. Our guest today, Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman, who is a member of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association, Mark Bookman, co-director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. If you have a question or a comment, we know this is a contentious issue. 1-800-729-7532. Send it to, you could send an email to smarttalk@witf.com. smarttalkwitf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I want to get into some of the specifics in the report. Mark Bookman, Mr. Sibman just brought up the issue of appeals. That was addressed in the report to a degree. Now, it seemed to say, what he seemed to say is that those that are obviously guilty, that one of the reasons that this takes so long is that the appeals process is so long. Also in the report, it is pointed out is that death sentences are much more costly because of that appeals process. But at the same time, if you reduce the appeals process, the possibility arises that an innocent person, more of a possibility arises that an innocent person will be executed. So how does the report address the appeals process, whether it should stay the same, whether it should be lengthened, reduced, just what?
Well, okay, so Mr. Stedman made a lot of points, and I really would like to address all of them. Let me start with the streamlining of appeals, and you've just put your finger on the problem here, Scott. That, you know, well over 100, close to 200 cases have been reversed by the appellate courts, and they have not been reversed because the courtroom door was left open. They've been reversed because of major problems in the prosecution, prosecutorial misconduct, withholding of evidence, wrongfully striking African-American jurors, many ineffective lawyering by the defense, many substantive reasons. So when we talk about streamlining appeals, you know, there's a visceral attraction there that doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. If we streamline appeals, we're going to be moving closer to executing people who should not be executed, not only because they're innocent, but because important information was kept from the jury, sexual abuse, physical abuse, intellectual disability. So it's dangerous when we start talking about streamlining appeals. And when we say that the victim did not get an appeal, that's an obvious statement. But what it's the implication of that statement is that we, our justice system, our community, should act in the same way as a heinous murderer acts. There's no question that some of these cases are horrific. There's no question that some of them just are affecting our consciousness in a way that is unhealthy. But that doesn't mean that we should act that way. The fact that someone killed someone unreasonably and deprived them of an appeal doesn't mean we should be acting as a justice system to deprive the person that's convicted of an appeal. That's the first thing. The second thing is we are misled when we say that the death penalty is popular in this country. The fact is it's not. When the public is asked, how do you feel about the death penalty? About 60% say it's a good idea, but that's the wrong question. Intelligent polls ask a different question. What they ask is, if you had the choice between the death penalty or life without the possibility of parole and restitution to the victims, which would you prefer? A majority prefer life without parole and restitution to the victims. Some actually believe in life with parole. So it's a misconception to think that this is a popular public issue. It's not. We simply have to be asking the right questions.
Mm-hmm. So, Craig Stibben, your response to that?
Well, a couple things. So, first of all, when you talk about the victims not having a right to appeal, what I'm emphasizing there is they've lost their life. Their life was taken from them by the choice of a defendant. A defendant, remember, everybody we're talking about has been convicted by 12 jurors who didn't know anything about this case, who said that person killed this person or more. So you should not in any way diminish the fact that the victims don't have a voice. No one's talking about, and I hope he didn't suggest this. If he did, I'm certainly offended, that we haul people out without trial, without any appellate process, without a robust appellate process, and just execute them and torture them as their victim. Maybe people feel that way. That's not what the DAs feel. That's not what the law is. That's not the right thing to do. But we get statements like this. He took two daughters and three grandchildren away and left one grandson without a mother. I will never get to see those three children grow, and he gets to live every single day. Those that you cannot diminish, you know, so many. What I see is the victims' voices and the survivors are lost. I mean, talking about restitution, I don't really think, you know, what you're talking about is paying for their funeral. And there's no family that would say, okay, I'll take compensation for their funeral instead of this. And one of the things that always stood out for me was one of the justices from the Supreme Court said, I would not presume to tell parents whose life has been forever altered by the brutal murder of a child that life imprisonment is punishment enough. And one of the broader concerns that we have is that if you say, okay, let's get rid of the death penalty, where we've decided to get rid of the death penalty, what's going to happen next? Right now in Pennsylvania, you have life without parole, and a lot of the anti-death penalty positions say that's enough, life without parole is enough. But what we're going to see is a sliding scale that's going to cost accountability, it's going to cost justice, because the day the death penalty is no longer in the books, what you're going to see is those same people, almost all those same people, will now start attacking life without parole. And I would ask Mr. Bookman, you know, today, is he willing to say that, yeah, let's do that. Let's get rid of the death penalty, but we won't go after life without parole, because the next thing you'll see, that's the next goalpost that'll be moved, will be, nope, and it's already going that way. Let's have terms, let's have geriatric, let's let them out, and those are all important discussions. But what's going to happen is it's going to be eroded, and we have it on the books now, it's what the law is. And I'd also emphasize about, you know, convicting an innocent person, that's the last thing we want to do. And believe me, having done these death penalty cases, we need to understand that the death penalty cases that we're getting today of 2018 would have gotten the death penalty in the 60s and 70s, where you'll see a lot of these things that are overturned. It's very, very different. Jurors now, they want to be, in essence, sure. I've been in there. I've looked at them. They want to know that the person absolutely is guilty, and this is what they're following the law to do it. And we have technology to do that now. So you can't confuse innocence and exoneration. They're not synonymous. Just because we've overturned a case because a jury instruction was wrong, that doesn't make the person any less guilty or any less of a murderer. And that's what most of these things are. You know,
can I interrupt for a second, Craig? Let me just...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, something I wanted to say is that in this report, there is no specific recommendation that the death penalty be eliminated. This report, and, you know, so I know that we can have this bigger discussion of pro and con death penalty, but getting back to the report itself, there's nothing in there that says that the death penalty should be eliminated.
I think the whole report essentially says that on every page. It may not literally say that, but that's what the report says. And that's important. I think we have to have that discussion. You know, I respect Mr. Bookman. I respect all these different opinions. Let's have this discussion. But right now we have a law. And we need to make sure that while we have that law, that it's being carried out, and that this just isn't just a fraud. You know, the bigger debate can go on in the political circles, in our discussions and shows like yours, which take on important issues like this. But right now, this is on the books, and we're not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So quality of life, which is what's at stake here for the death sentence, that was not the sentence of the jury. That was not the sentence in the courtroom, that the person would be, you know, in more solitary confinement and have a different, not in general population. That's really what's being decided in our courtrooms, and that's what the law is on the books. So we have an obligation to make sure what's on the books right now needs to work. So, you know, I think the study is flawed. You know, I've gone through that, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be talking about these issues, and we're not open to making it work.
Let's look at some recommendations.
Yeah, Scott, can I
sure,
get a
go
word
ahead.
In
go ahead.
Edgewise
go
here?
Ahead,
thanks.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, let's just stay with the facts. Here's the fact of the cases that have been reversed. Well, more than 100 of those cases that were reversed, not for trivia, but for real reasons. After they were reversed, over 95% of them, when they went back to a retrial or resentencing, ended in a life sentence or less. That's just a fact. Over 95%. What that tells us is that when these major errors get made. And when I say major errors, I'm talking about I'm not accusing anyone specifically, but prosecutors withholding discovery, police reports, prosecutors wrongfully striking jurors. There's, you know, dozens of these cases that are well documented in our courts. After those mistakes get rectified, more than 95% of the defendants that are retried end up with a life sentence or less. That tells us that, one, these mistakes are major, and two, that if a case is handled properly, it's much less likely to resolve itself in a life sentence or less. The second idea is that our appellate courts have run amok here, and this is kind of a common theme among pro-death penalty supporters. The reality, the fact is, our state courts have reversed more than twice the number of our federal courts. So, you know, these are state judges in the courts of common pleas or the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania making these reversals. It's not federal courts that have gone crazy. It's our state courts that are recognizing these problems. So I don't think anyone claims that we're taking defendants out behind the courthouse and shooting them. We have a failed system, as the report well documents. No, they don't say that we should get rid of the death penalty. The implicit suggestion is that if we want to fix the death penalty, it's going to cost us a lot of money. So from a public policy decision, when we look at the changes that are recommended, there's changes that are going to cost a lot of money. And the decision we have to make is, are we satisfied with putting convicted murderers in prison for the rest of their lives, or do we want to spend this huge amount of money that could be spent on more police officers, on more safety on the streets, on better schools? That's a public policy decision that I think the study leaves to us. There are expensive solutions here. One is the formation of a statewide capital defender office. One of the biggest problems in the state is lawyers that are under-resourced, under-trained, and relatively inexperienced when it comes to the death penalty.
Can I interrupt for a second? Because that's one of the things that was in the report, that someone who is a defendant who is represented by a public defender on the county level is much more likely to be sentenced to death than if, you know, that person had gotten his or her own attorney. And the recommendation you just talked about, that there would be a creation of capital defenders, how much would that cost? That's one of the big questions that many people would have.
And it's a legitimate question. Let's be careful about the public defender becoming more likely to get a death sentence. In Philadelphia, the public defender's office started handling capital cases in 1993, and they did it according to the ABA standards. And from 1993 to 2018, they've never taken a single death sentence, while private court-appointed lawyers have taken more than 80. So we have to be real careful about deciding. It's not just across the board that public defenders are worse. The public defenders that get worse, worse results, are public defender offices in the counties that are not nearly as well resourced and not nearly as well trained. How much is it going to cost? You know, district attorneys for years have been saying that there's no price to justice. The ABA standards recommend two lawyers in every capital case, a mitigation specialist, that's someone that looks into the background of the defendant, and a fact investigator.
Can I interrupt for a second? Because there's so much information I want to get to, and I want to have Craig Stedman respond to this. Mr. Stedman, I mean, I think that most people would agree, I don't know whether you do or not, but most people would agree that public defenders on the county level are underfunded. They don't have the kind of resources to handle these cases on a regular basis. I mean, they can't put the time, they can't put the research into it. So would you disagree with this recommendation for the creation of, some kind of capital lawyers, association, if you will, that would handle these cases?
Yeah, not the concept, because the solution to create a new agency, yes. But let me be clear that we want a good defense, and these defenders are funded at the county level, and just because, you know, it's a different level of government than some states does not mean they're deficient. And it's important that, you know, there's a lot of finances that go into, and that's going to tie into some of the things that Mr. Bookman brought up, a lot of finances that go into the defense that actually we're not available. I mean, the same funding mechanism for the defense, the public defenders in my county, is the same one that funds us. You know, my attorneys, I got guys in their 20s or in their early 30s trying death penalty cases at the county level. But we absolutely want a robust defense. What we do see is there's about $20 million for the federal capital defenders out there. That's a pool, a giant gold mine that they have essentially bottomless resources that they put in the defense of these cases as they go through the process, the PCRAs. And they flat out, their goal is to delay and get the person. They have an agenda. You know, their purpose is to get the person off the death sentence. That's what they exist for, and they have essentially a bottomless pit of resources. You know, $20 million, my entire budget for my whole year for my whole office is about $7 million. So they can just sink money after money into this, and they wear you out. In fact, one of them had told me on an appeal I was handling, like, we are going to out-resource you until you give in. And what happens when he's talking about 95% of these cases that are overturned or sent back for sentencing, what happens is that sometimes that takes place 20 or 30 years after the trial. We've lost our witnesses. We lost the ability to retry it. And in my personal case, I had a case where an individual broke into his ex-wife's home, kicked the door in because she was dating somebody else, even though he was dating somebody. He brought two clips of ammunition. He shot her from the legs and arms first, emptied one clip, so he didn't kill her. So she suffered while she begged for her life, and he ended up shooting her 17 times. He finally ends up killing her. And this was over. He got the death sentence, and it was overturned because one of the aggravating circumstance in that case was there was a PFA, and that's one of the limited circumstances you can get the death penalty on is if a victim was protected by a PFA. And in this case, that's what caused him to kill her on the phone. She told him about the PFA. He came over and he killed her because she had gotten a PFA. But the courts on the appeal said, well, he wasn't, even though he knew about it, he wasn't actually served with the paper. So we had to retry that case. So we sat down with the victim's family, the surviving members of the family, and we said, do you want to go through this again years afterwards? And their answer was, we can't take it.
But let me go back then.
We want it to be over. And the other thing I would just say real quick about the fact that you have all these things overturned and that percentage, I think what that actually is a testament to is the robust appeals that we have. And so the very argument against the death penalty proves that thing establishes the reason we should have the death penalty for the ones that get through. If you can actually manage to get through the appellate process in Pennsylvania and then the Supreme Court and the federal courts and system, you know, you've got a very strong case, and we should be at least starting out with those people. And so I would say the robust appeal process and the results are actually an argument for why we should be executing the ones that get through.
But I want to go back to the original question of effectiveness of counsel. If you have an effective counsel, someone who's experienced in capital cases, someone that's their only job to work on capital cases, doesn't that mean there would be less room for appeal? Granted, now we have a lot of appeals with capital cases, but if you have an effective counsel in the original trial, doesn't that say that there is less room for appeal? Maybe that reduces the appeal process.
Yeah, I think that we want, like I said, we 100% want effective counsel. And right now, there's no real consequence to the defense attorneys if they're ineffective.
Okay,
and
Martin,
maybe that's something we should be looking at. And maybe there should be some conditions and there should be some consequence to somebody. Like maybe if you're found ineffective, you shouldn't be able to do these capital cases. And I think that's an important debate. But you know, there's no disagreement on any side of the spectrum here that we want strong defense. Mm-hmm. And because it will come back. Nothing gets through all these levels of scrutiny. You won't even get first the first level, but if you do, you're not going to go much beyond that if you've got an ineffective counsel. And no one wants to retry these cases. They are so painful. It is like putting these families through it again. And you know what? Let's also add the defendants' families.
Yeah.
And there
Mark.
Too. They didn't do anything wrong. And they're suffering through this as well. Everyone suffers. And so you want to do it right. You want to get it in the first place. I think that, like I said, I think, you know, where you put the funding, it depends. If you're going to create a whole other agency, maybe we ought to be creating a statewide prosecutorial capital unit and with the same argument and give them the same funding and let's go. Because I don't get any help from the state. There's no federal Prosecutors Association that gives me, as I have access
Craig,
to the
Craig, let me have Mark, so, let me know, have Mark jump in here.
Let's have it balanced. We want to make sure it's fair to the defendants, but it's fair to the victims and the prosecutors as well.
Go ahead, Mark.
I know Mr. Stedman is an elected official, so he can go on a little bit more than I can, but let me just, you know, address some of the
That's
again,
not super nice, Mark.
That he raised.
Come on. I take my job very, very seriously, but I'm assuming you're just...
I understand. So let me just address some of these points. First of all, I understand that the system is underfunded. The state prosecutors, or the local prosecutors, they don't just have their own budget. They also have the police to investigate the case. They have the crime lab, and they have the medical examiner's office. These are all aspects of the study that of the case that the defense doesn't have. The defense has to ask for money for all of these things. When the federal defender has this pot of money that Mr. Stedman is talking about, you can't buy a court. You can't buy a court opinion. In other words, you can spend $1 billion. If the issue is not there for the courts to find, it's not there. So what we're really saying is, you know, if you underfund at the very beginning and you don't do an effective job as a defense attorney, it is important for the lawyers to come in afterwards and say, look, this was screwed up, that was screwed up. If lawyers don't do that, then we're going to end up executing people who shouldn't be executed. Here's where we are short-sighted. The Rand Corporation did an incredible study. I don't know if it was mentioned in the report or not, but it probably should have been. What the Rand study did was they looked at the public defender office in Philadelphia that was handling capital cases, one out of every five cases. And what they found was if you were represented by the public defender's office, you were 61% less likely to be convicted of first-degree murder, 19% more likely to be acquitted, and your sentence all across the board was 24% lower. So it showed that representation really does matter. But here's what the most important finding of the Rand study. Bad lawyering cost the public taxpayer over $200 million in costs, over $200 million in an 11-year period. So what we're doing by not properly funding these cases is we're being incredibly penny wise and pound foolish. Now, how much, you know, how much is a statewide office going to cost? It's probably going to cost us more up front. But in the long run, when you consider the $200 million that's being wasted, it's not money that's badly spent at all. It's money that should be spent. And in fact, I think the Rand study is in fact cited in the Pennsylvania study. So we've got to be smarter with our money if we're really going to have this policy, which I think is foolish myself. But if we're going to have it, then we've got to spend the money to do it correctly. I can't imagine that Mr. Stedman is against that. A fundamental point.
We have about 15 minutes left, and there are a few other issues I want to get to, as well as some phone calls. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. There are a lot of issues to cover when we talk about the death penalty and the reports, and I ask our guests to be a little more, just a little bit shorter with your answers, since we do have about 14 minutes left in the program. I'm going to take some phone calls here. Joe is in Lancaster. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, sure. I hope I can hold this together because it makes me nervous 70 years later to talk about it. I want to address Craig Stedman's main argument, which is that we owe it to the victims and the victims' family to kill these people. My father was bludgeoned to death when I was 5 years old. That was 70 years ago and change. 5 years after that, I was in Steinfels in Lancaster. It used to be a little corner magazine store where the kids used to hang around and play pinball and buy Adam crackers and stuff like that. And I read the paper at the describing the execution of the Rosenbergs. And when I read that paper, the glee that was exhibited by some about killing his mother and father, traitors, was really distressing to me. And I couldn't help but notice that the Rosenbergs had children. And I thought to myself, not, oh, good, we're killing murderers or we're killing bad people. I thought to myself, here is one more tragedy from my own point of view. I had a father. He was killed. The Rosenbergs' kids, they had a father and mother. They were killed. So when Craig Stedman opines that victims are all in favor of, and he doesn't want to hurt them by not killing the murderers, he's not speaking for anybody but himself. Many victims' families probably agree with him. Many others don't. And well, that's what I want to say.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. Before Craig Stedman, before we get to that, let me get to another phone call here. Barbara is in Harrisburg. Barbara, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have to say, in regards to your last caller, I agree totally with Attorney Stedman. My brother was murdered 32 years ago. The gentleman that murdered him admitted to it. They are sitting in jail. Their family get to see them every visiting day. I don't get to see my brother. My sons don't get to see their uncle. Once a convicted murderer has confessed that he has done it, that it has been proven with this, a shadow of a doubt, proceed with the death penalty. Take the money that you're saving from housing these animals for the rest of their lives and put it into streamlining and fixing the system so things are not held up in appeals courts forever.
Mm. Barbara,
if you want to go back to the Bible, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You took a life, we take your life.
Barbara, thank you very much for calling. Sorry to hear about those tragedies in both of those callers' lives. Gentlemen, we only have a few minutes left, and I do want to get on to a couple other things.
You know, can I just respond to the one caller?
Sure.
I mean, first of all,
can you do it?
He's talking about the Roseboro case. And the Roseboro was not a death penalty case.
He's talking about Rosenbergs. He's talking about Rosenbergs in the 1950s.
The
Russian spies.
Oh. Well, I have nothing to do with that. And
I know.
We certainly don't take pleasure, and I emphasize that in my first comments, in going after the death penalty. It's just absolutely tragic all around for everybody on both sides. And with respect to the, you know, we drive the death penalty regardless of victims that oppose it. We have detailed, lengthy discussions, heart-to-heart discussions, the worst thing that's ever happened with the victims' families. And personally, you know, that they're the ones, we're going to move on to other cases. We won't forget them, but we're going to move on to other cases. And what they're left with is every single day thinking about their lost loved ones. So when they're not in favor of the death penalty, that carries extreme amount of weight to me. In fact, before I was DA, I was told to go do a death penalty. The guy wouldn't plead. The one family member did not want to proceed on religious grounds. She couldn't do it. I just went in and I said, I am not proceeding. I'm not going to do this because it was going to be way harder on her than for us to proceed. Even though the facts were terrible and she'd burned her mother to strangled and burned her mother to death. I just want to be clear,
right,
as DAs.
I understand that. Let me, again, I'm going to have to ask you guys to be a little bit shorter with your answers because there's a couple of things I want to hit on in the report. Recommendations from the committee, including looking at whether the death sentences are disproportionate in terms of more black defendants sentenced to death than whites. Half of those on death row in Pennsylvania are black. We also, in the report, found that the defendants are more likely to be sentenced to death if the victim is white, and more so if the victim is a white woman. Mark Bookman, if you could be like 60 seconds or less, and I'll ask the same thing of Craig Stedman.
Sure. So the disparity by victim race is common, not only in Pennsylvania, but across the country. So, you know, this is the best way to determine discrimination, and it's something that the system is always going to have. In McCleskey versus Kemp, a very famous case from 1987, the Supreme Court was confronted with this sort of race discrimination, and they sort of passed the buck, and it prompted Justice Brennan to say that the reason the courts are not fixing this race discrimination problem is a fear of too much justice. It's incredibly difficult to eradicate discrimination from the death penalty.
Who discriminates? Who discriminates?
Well, a jury that is more likely to impose death on a white victim, that basically tells us that juries, prosecutors, everybody in the system values white lives more than black lives.
Craig Stedman, what about that disparity?
That all sounds good until you look at the actual data and the Kramer study, which the key issue was this issue. And it's important, but they flat, I'm just going to read it. No pattern of disparity to the disadvantage of black or Hispanic defendants was found in prosecutorial decisions to seek and, if sought, to retract the death penalty. Black defendants with white victims were not more likely to receive the death penalty than defendants in other type of cases. And they say, you know, what they found when they did the study across the state, again, much more recent than the other studies, the Baldus study that's cited in there. It just isn't there.
But why are there twice as many?
It may be in other states, but I agree with Mark when he's talking about, let's look at the facts. And the facts are, the Penn State study, an independent study, said you just don't have it. We shouldn't be aware of it. That doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it. I mean, we cannot have any kind of racial prejudice in the justice system. It has to be equal justice for all. Those words have to mean something, and that's the oath we take, and we must absolutely follow that.
Craig, why are there twice as many black defendants on death row than white?
Well, you know, we follow the facts. When we get the calls, we say, here's a shooter. Then we don't ask what race it is. You know, the person, oh, is he black or is he white? You know, the police respond. You follow the facts. And I think you're getting into much broader issues of economy and those type of societal issues. But remember, typically what we see with the defendant's race is, most of the time, the race of the victim is the same as the race of the perpetrator.
Right.
So you need to stand up for the defendants and make sure they get fair representation. But you need to stand up for the victims as well. So that's you want me to keep my answer short? I don't know.
Yeah,
if I can answer.
No, I know. I know what you. And I know I'm asking a lot of you guys. I know I'm asking a lot of you guys because these are big issues. We only have about 3 minutes left. Another issue that was a recommendation that came out of the report had to do with mental illness and intellectual disabilities. The U.S. Supreme Court said that it is unconstitutional to execute a defendant who is intellectually disabled. Mental illness, that's a different story. The recommendation that judges determine intellectual disability in the pretrial stage rather than waiting for the jury to do it post-trial. Craig Stedman, 60 seconds or so.
Okay, so that sounds good in an ivory tower, not works in the real world, because what you'll have is you'll have delays, you'll have people filing things to get it done early on, and what you'll have is an appeal based on that decision about whether they could do it. And that, we're talking about years, which means justice even more delayed for the victims. Witnesses will be intimidated, and you're going to have a trial before a trial, because to talk about a person's intellectual issue, you have to introduce the facts surrounding the crime. You know, what was the plan? What were the decisions? What were the complexity? Which means you're going to have to have a trial before a trial. Look, we trust juries. That's the foundation of our justice system in the country. Juries have that decision. There are significant protections in place to ensure that intellectually disabled are not subject to the death penalty. There's layers upon layers, and I'm trying to be very brief.
I know. Mark Bookman,
but to go into that would take some time.
This recommendation is quite a simple one. If someone is intellectually disabled, they're not eligible for the death penalty. So if someone is intellectually disabled, rather than go through the entire process, rather than pick a lengthy jury and go to a lengthy capital jury trial, this recommendation is quite simple. If you find out he's intellectually disabled before the case starts or before the trial starts, then it's no longer a capital case. It's no longer, and that saves everyone money. That's the basis of the recommendation, and it makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Couple of emails here. Kathleen in York wanted to make sure that I got this in, and she's correct. There are many false confessions, plus the criminal justice standard is, when I say she's right about the false confessions. I'm just adding reading what she has here. Plus the criminal justice standard is not beyond a reasonable doubt. And stop saying that the daughters wanted the death penalty for their father and stepmom in Lancaster. I think she's referring to the case that you referred to earlier, Craig Stedman. He fought them to seek it, saying that what case is she talking about? You had mentioned a case that...
I don't know. a lot of I've done, unfortunately, all too many of these cases, and sometimes you have differences of opinions and family members, and that becomes a very, very difficult decision for us. Sometimes they're unanimous; they want the death penalty. Sometimes they're not. But we always look at the, you know, the strength of the case and the severity of the case, and we everybody's view is important. There are certain people, you know, sometimes you almost have to look at, like, who's the closest relation, what do they want. Of course, we also have we're ministers of justice, and you've got to balance that. It's very, very difficult. So I don't know exactly which case she's talking about.
She said Nick Yaris.
Leroy Stallworth, it was the mother that made the decision that she, second time around, did not want to go through it. If it was Landon May, there was a difference of opinion in there.
Okay.
But again, I know you want to cut me off.
Yeah, I want to cut both of you off. I have to, gentlemen. There's so much to talk about. Mark Bookman, co-director of Atlantic City for Capital Representation, Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman. There is a comprehensive report about the report on our website, WITF.org, under Smart Talk. Take a look at it. Gentlemen, I know we only covered a little area. Thank you very much for being with us today.